And good afternoon. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Hudson, and Catskill, 90.7. That's right. And WGXC.org if you're listening live on the computer everywhere in the world. And this is Chad Weckler, the host for the next hour of the Art of the Hudson Valley. And we have in the studio Tony Fletcher, who is no stranger to WGXC because he had his own music program here a few years ago. And he is the author of a new book called In the Midnight Hour, The Life and Soul of Wilson Pickett, which is published by Oxford University Press. And is this the first week that this is the breaking out?
Yeah, you're my second interview, Chad. Just came down from WAMC. The book came out yesterday. I was in England for Christmas and New Year and just starting on the interview process. So, yes, the book was published yesterday, January 4th, in the States.
And in the book, which is a, I feel like you made the reader, myself as one, sort of put into the orbit of Wilson Pickett and I felt often in the room, whether it was in a performance in the studio or in a hotel room or wherever he was at the point. So I really enjoyed your take on how to do a biography, because was this a different biography for you? Because you've done quite a few.
Yes, I have done a few, but it was very different in the sense of it's the first time I've written exclusively about an African-American artist. Mm. I wrote a book about the New York City music scene called All Hopped Up and Ready to Go, which actually was the title of my radio show back here on GXC before I went traveling last year. I had a lot of fun doing that show, actually. It's nice to be back in the studio. But that book about the New York City scene had me much more immersed in African-American and Cuban-American, Latino, Afro-Cuban music forms, and it felt like I pulled it off okay. So that gave me the confidence to do this subject. But this was the first time, not the first time researching down south at all, because I also wrote about REM, who are from Georgia, but the first time being immersed in a story that begins in the cotton fields of Alabama and involves a lot of the issues of segregation, of race, of racial segregation within music and outside of music, and the struggle of a black person to make themselves heard beyond the church and into the charts. And so in many ways, it was a new process for me. And at the risk of a long answer to an initial question, it was a remarkably easy process. The family was cooperative. Pretty much everybody I approached was cooperative. Doors opened for me. Enough doors opened that the few that stayed shut really weren't too big a concern. Mm. From a research point of view, considering that I did say to myself, well, this is going to be something new and you better get your research done well, it was a joy for the process to be as painless as it was in terms of interviewing people.
And Wilson Pickett is actually Wilson Pickett Jr. And he did start as in the church, singing gospel at a very young age. And as you mentioned in the book, he took that singing out into the cotton fields with him. So he got his start in gospel music.
Very, very much so, as did so many of the soul singers. In fact, arguably, I think probably every single one of them had some kind of background in the church. And there's an approach where you kind of come to it, depending where your religious beliefs are, where you might think, well, how does gospel morph into rhythm and blues and rock and roll? Now, there's a couple of things, because for one, Wilson was actually very religious, and his tombstone, his mausoleum, in the mausoleum actually has the Lord's Prayer on his mausoleum. That's its own dichotomy. But if you were young and black and work in the cotton fields, your only real opportunity to sing was to sing gospel. The white man left you alone to sing in the church. He left you alone in your church, effectively. That was your culture. That was your, not just your spiritual home, it was your social home and your musical home. So The fact is that somebody like Pickett did believe what he was singing, but even if he hadn't believed it, it's where he could sing and where he could sing with the voice that some form of God gifted him with that allowed him not just to sing but to shout and scream, but shout and scream in tune. Mm. He was not. It's the really important thing about Pickett is he's got, to my money, the loudest voice in all of soul music, but it's not shouting for shouting's sake. He can hold those notes. He can do a scream and turn it into a melisma while screaming. So an amazing voice that, yes, got its background in church, and he was very clear later on that his voice would not have held out as well as it did if he didn't have that schooling, that training from singing in his local church.
But it was basically he was self-taught, wouldn't you say? I mean, he absorbed what was around him in the church, but he was self-taught.
He was definitely self-taught. There wasn't too much teaching going on. Schooling was very minimal. Traditionally, the schooling was it was segregated, and with a view that even if you made it all the way to graduation, really the trainings were with a view to your having a career probably in the cotton fields, but maybe in some kind of factory. So there was very little other training going on. But people grew up in families. His father was, his grandfather, who was very, very much involved in raising him, was a preacher. And apparently his mother had a good voice. And if you are taken to church every Sunday and it's not an option from the age of being a baby and you are surrounded by beautiful voices and powerful voices, if you've got half a voice, chances are that you'll find a way to use it.
Now, soon afterwards, he did make a major move physically, which was going to Detroit.
Yes.
What was that move like for him, and how did it change him?
Well, he had spent time in Detroit as a small boy. His father moved up when he was very small as part of the second wave of what we call the Great Migration North, where I think in all about 2.5 million African Americans moved out of the South and up to the northern industrial cities. I note in the book from going to some museums and seeing the pattern that depending where you came from, sort of Mississippi, people would end up in Chicago. People from Alabama would typically end up in Detroit, maybe Cleveland, but very, very much Detroit. And so his father made that journey up there following his own brother, and he called back for members of the family. Wilson was one of the fourth of a family that ultimately had 11 of a mother that ultimately had 11 kids. There was quite a bit of back and forth, and he ended up being moved back at a young age, and I feel that was probably quite hard on him, because in Detroit he lived within a self-contained, albeit segregated, but self-contained, thriving black community, arguably possibly the most thriving black community in America, outside of and possibly including Harlem, because Detroit was financially really moving with the car industry. So having come back from somewhere where the church was next to the bar, which was next to the barbers, which was next to the nightclub, which was next to the funeral parlor and the grocery store and all the other points in between, he had to come back to the cotton fields, and it was evident that he just wanted out. I think even at the age of 7, having seen the big city, he knew his future was not back down south. So he really didn't put in the energy at school. He had the voice. He was getting into trouble. His parents agreed that it would be best for him to go up to Detroit and live with his father. And so it was. He was one of the many, many, many singers. A lot of the Motown singers came up from Alabama or Mississippi around a similar age who just said, this is where I want to be. This is where the music's at. And Detroit, this is 5 years before Motown really got going, but Detroit was just jumping in the mid-50s, just truly jumping. It had people like Little Willie John and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters. It was it was a really happening place before Motown happened, and it partly helps explain why Motown happened. So it was the right call.
I forgot to tell our listeners Wilson was born in 1941. So that puts us in sort of a perspective where At the when I think about, of course, at the end of the book, Wilson dies.
Mm-hmm. Spoiler
alert. Not that old.
Not that old, and not tragically young either, which is one reason. I was obviously joking, spoiler alert, but I am running into people who very nicely say, well, can you just remind me or refresh me, is Wilson Pickett still alive? Because he's sort of, at the end, his body kind of faded away. I make the point early on that, and I think in the introduction, that one reason he's not had the books written about him is he didn't die at a peak like an Otis Redding or a Sam Cooke, who both had tragic, albeit very different deaths, right at the peak of their careers.
Or Dwayne Allman.
Or Dwayne Allman, who played, although I'm thinking of the soul singers, but obviously like a Dwayne Allman. And also he didn't have the longevity of a James Brown, who spanned, or Ray Charles, who spanned, had the 50s. In there, I mean, Pickett did record in the 50s, but who had proper hit records and influence in the 50s. So his he did die at the age of 64. We're jumping to the end, but his body kind of gave up on him. I mean, in terms of what the final cause of death was, there's a little bit of confusion, but there were many problems with his internal organs by that point. So no, it's not that old. That's the result of a life hard lived, really.
And that's also sort of the I don't know if it's said in the book, but it was said in the book. He was his own worst enemy.
It was said to me frequently by so many people. I think the first one who says it in there is Lloyd Price. Now, Lloyd Price is still alive. That's the guy who first wrote and recorded and had a hit record with Lordy Miss Claudy long before Elvis covered it on his first album. He put out Pickett's first solo hit record, If You Need Me, which was a bigger hit for Solomon Burke. There's a great story about the two records competing against each other. And Lloyd Price is still alive and very, very well. And he was, I think he's the first person quoted in the book to say that Pickett was just his own worst enemy. But I heard it from a lot of people.
You brought up cover, which to me it was an education to read the book, because so many of Wilson's hits, as per, you know, even the Rolling Stones, you know, the list goes on. They were doing covers and they did it successfully, where it also again became a hit. And Mustang Sally is a cover.
A lot of Pickett's biggest records are in fact covers. That was in soul music. A lot of it was about just singing a combination of the hit records of the time, just like British bands got started doing the same thing. Between covering hits of the time, but also a sense of trying to make a song your own. Each song has a different kind of story to it, because Mustang Sally was written and recorded by Sir Mac Rice. Mac Rice to his mother and father. No Queen's Honours list on it for Sir Mac Rice. But that was the only other, there wasn't actually quite the only other recorded version. The Rascals had done quite a slow version on the B-side of, I think, Good Loving. So it was sitting in a lot of people's homes. But Mustang Sally, Wilson Pickett and Mac Rice, who wrote and first recorded that song, had been in the Falcons together in Detroit. That was Pickett's major group. When he went to Detroit, he did gospel. He had a good run of it with a group called the Violinaires. I was able to find one living member who remembered Wilson. Found him down in Florida. He had very strong and very positive memories of Wilson. Then he joined the Falcons, which was a phenomenal vocal group. It's often claimed that they were the world's first soul group. Maybe not because they were considered that at the time, but it was Eddie Floyd's group. It was managed by Eddie Floyd's uncle, and the singer that preceded and then actually came back in with Wilson Pickett was Levi Stubbs' brother, Joe Stubbs, who maybe had the better voice. It also featured Wilson Pickett and Mac Rice. I mean, that's what you consider an all-star group. And they made quite a lot of records together, which I found the love is really that one was written by Pickett, and it's an astonishing recording that hopefully we could play that in a minute. So there were many different reasons for picking up a song and recording it. I think with Mustang Sally, when Pickett first heard it, when he first heard his friend Mac Rice do it, I think he got an inkling then, I'd like to do that song. And when Mac Rice's version was just a moderate R&B hit, and that didn't get much further than top 40 of the R&B charts, then I think Pickett marked it and said, I'll do that at some point. And of course, made the definitive version.
And Mac didn't have that scream Pickett brought to that song.
No, Mac Rice was actually a pretty good songwriter, wrote a number of really good songs. But he wasn't the greatest singer, and Pickett certainly was.
In a way, you know, just before we went on in the air, I was talking about a song, Don't Knock My Love, which if you go to YouTube, which was very helpful to have some of the songs in the book sort of stand out and be able to go to the computer and go to YouTube and see the actual, hear the songs. And sometimes they're always different because he performed differently in the studio than he did live.
Yes, he did, yeah.
And he loved going into the studio. Why was that?
Pickett was a, you know, well, I mean, I was about to say, which I haven't don't say in the book, I was about to say he was a workaholic. I mean, he actually also became an alcoholic. And you've got these thoughts going through my head, because eventually when you become an alcoholic, you can't be a workaholic. You can't be both. Mm. But he knew that he had a gift and he wanted to make the most of it. He also definitely wanted to get paid for it. There's nothing wrong with that. Mm. But this was a guy who loved making music. And for all that he also was, I would say, shamanistic on stage based on the evidence that we have on YouTube and elsewhere and from people who saw him in his heyday, for all that he was shamanistic on stage, I think he preferred being in the studio. He could work quickly and he was very a very commanding presence, regardless of the producer, regardless of the band. He always had a very good instinct for what a song should sound like, how he should sing it. There's really, throughout the Atlantic days, not a bad vocal performance. But you're right, when he would take the, during his heyday, when he would take the songs on the road, depending on which band he had, the band would make those songs more their own. I think later on it became a little bit of the kind of, you know, the standard hits medley show that we now recognize. If we see older artists, we get their best hits, we get a medley of a few others and they disappear for 5 minutes and let the band vamp while they take a breather. He ended up doing that, but for a while there he was I think the live shows were phenomenal, but he was not looking to emulate James Brown as the hardest working man in show music, show business. He was looking to better James Brown as a singer and recording artist. And I do think that during Pickett's heyday, those two stand, you know, very, very close together, really close together.
Would you say that the lightning in the bottle was the mid-60s for him?
Yes, I would. But, well, it starts with the, well, you know what? I'd like to do something, because I know you've got the CDs. You got the first one queued up. Before we jump into the 60s, just to set the tone of his voice, if we could just hear a little bit of his hit for the Falcons, I Found a Love. I think it's track one on there on the first CD.
Yes, it is.
And this was a top 10 R&B hit, not a big pop hit, but I think it was just too damn raw to be a big pop hit. It's just a tremendous vocal performance, shattering, I think.
Well, let's see if I can get it right on here on the old board.
Yep, I'm familiar with the, as I call them, the eccentricities of the studio here. I can always vamp for you if you need it.
We got it.
You're up.
One thing I right here. The way the woman walk. She set my love so on fire. The way she talk. She my heart.
So that was the Falcons?
Yes.
So tell us, Tony, a little bit about that song and the Falcons.
Well, the Falcons were, like I was saying, they're Eddie Floyd's vocal group. And after a couple of lineup changes, they'd had a hit record with You're So Fine, like a proper hit record. They'd been on American Bandstand. They were sort of pop stars, but were having trouble following it up. But Joe Stubbs, the main singer, wanted to decided the group should be named after him, so it should be Joe Stubbs and the Falcons. And Eddie's uncle was the manager, and they weren't having that, so they called Joe's bluff. And right around that point, the bass singer Willie Schofield, who had written "You're So Fine," realized that the money was more in management, based on the meager royalty checks he was getting for "You're So Fine." He literally heard Wilson Pickett singing on his stoop, and basically took him on as a client, brought him into the Falcons when Joe Stubbs was thrown out. They meandered around a little bit because having one hit record meant they were being pushed to do a lot of commercial music. But Pickett, I think, really toughened them up. They were tough guys, there's no denying that, but he toughened them up vocally. And they recorded I Found a Love, the backing group. It's based on a Pentecostal hymn called Yes, Lord. But when they recorded it, the backing group was a group they'd met on their travels called the Ohio Untouchables. Robert Ward and the Ohio Untouchables. Robert Ward is the guitar player you hear there, that guitar playing is just truly astounding. And they did a couple more recordings with him later that are not quite as good, but pretty fine in their own right. The Ohio Untouchables, not without Robert Ward, became the Ohio Players. So even early on, Pickett was playing with the best. And I Found a Love was recorded. It was offered to Atlantic, who turned it down. Then it became a massive regional hit, and Atlantic had actually turned them down, I think. They turned that record down. They ended up picking it up. And the thing that I like about the fact that version is because it was recorded by the group and not by Atlantic, even though it ended up being a hit record on Atlantic. Atlantic was much cleaner than that. Their productions are much, much more. They're more sophisticated, but they're cleaner. And I love the way that Pickett's voice is. You can just imagine in the studio that needle bang up in the red, and somebody figuring like Pickett's too close to the mic. He's gonna shatter the glass in the studio. It's just a shattering. It is a shattering performance, and it was recognized by the R&B audience. Pickett was always looking to go solo. I think he felt this guy Willie Schofield had signed him as a solo act. Funny enough, he was in the Falcons for a couple of years. There was no publicity shot of him in the Falcons. The standard publicity shot is actually with Joe Stubbs in the group. So he did go solo as a result of that. But I think that record more than stands the test of time. And there's also at the end, I don't know if the casual listener would have picked it up, but towards the end of the song, the third verse, he says, and sometimes I call her in the midnight hour. And it would have been about 3 years later when he was paired up with Steve Cropper down at Stax in Memphis to write songs together, that one of them reverted to that. It was a phrase that Pickett was using, and I think that Cropper was pointed to I Found a Love as one of the only tracks that existed. That there were more than that. There were a few tracks that Pickett had recorded. I mean, by that point, including If You Need Me and a couple of minor hits. But that one influenced the song in the Midnight Hour. They decided to take that phrase and build a song out of it.
So that song we just heard, I Found a Love, when was that recorded?
That was recorded. It was recorded twice, and there was some dispute about which version was actually the one that Atlantic put out. But 1961.
So it's much earlier than, as you know, what we talked about, the Lightning in the Bottle, the sort of the 65, 66,
well, it's
67.
Why, it's why I wanted to play it, because I would have been among the first as a kid, and probably right up, I'll be honest, right up to the point of starting to immerse myself in Wilson's life to see if there was a story to tell. I might have felt, yeah, but did this guy's career, when did it start? I'm sure he was in groups before. I'm sure he recorded before In the Midnight Hour, but he had hit records. And If You Need Me was a big R&B hit, a bigger hit for Solomon Burke. He then had his own hit with It's Too Late, the follow-up. So he had his bona fides. That's why Atlantic signed him, because it was, I think, the third time they'd had the chance to sign Wilson Pickett. So they weren't going to let him get away a third time. So he had his bona fides. And then, to be honest, I think it's really important to say, Atlantic kind of messed it up for the first couple of singles. They did pair him up with Don Covey, who became Wilson Pickett's, one of his very closest friends. And Pickett recorded a Covey song actually the same week that Covey recorded Mercy Mercy, which was a much bigger record, both of them for Atlantic. And Mercy Mercy is actually the first ever recording with Jimi Hendrix on it. So Don Covey's band was better than Wilson Pickett's band, certainly on the guitarist front. Atlantic then messed it up by doing a full tilt and deciding to hook him up with a Barry Mann, Cynthia Weil song. They are two of the greatest American songwriters to ever have existed. But they were, you know, their big hit at the time was You've Lost That Loving Feeling. They were the big dramatic Brill Building style symphonic Phil Spector production. And that was not the right thing for Spector. So there was a record that Burt Burns produced called Come Home Baby, which was a total flop and a very expensive flop. And then the argument, the story goes, that Pickett had heard Otis Redding records while touring on the back of his earlier hit record, and said, "Well, that's the sound I want. And if that's recorded in Memphis, then get me back down south. I want to go there." And Jerry Wexler at the same time was actually distributing those Stax records through Atlantic. So he obviously knew where they were recorded. And Jerry Wexler at Atlantic, the famed Atlantic producer and part owner, had sent Sam and Dave, sort of loaned them to Stax over Atlantic signings, and thought they might actually fit in better in the Stax mold. So they were already recording there. So it was agreed that Wilson Pickett would go down to record. And on his first session, he did four songs, of which two of them were big R&B hits. And one of those was In the Midnight Hour, which I think I write in the book. I think it's, I may have used the word unimprovable. Like 50 years later, I don't think there's anything you can do to improve on that particular song.
And
recording.
This was in Muscle Shoals?
No. This is in Memphis. Fame Studios is in Muscle Shoals. But if we're taking it chronologically, then Pickett's next move, after having been in Detroit, having gone to New York City, having signed with Atlantic, recorded in New York City, and also recorded one over-the-top production that really wasn't right for him in New York City, he now went back down to Memphis to record at Stax. And that's where he recorded In the Midnight Hour, came back and did 6, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, went back a third time and did... it may have been the third time he was back there in a short period. He did 6, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9, and 99.5 won't do. And then, for reasons that have often been disputed and which I try and answer in the book, they're too complicated to go into now, Stax effectively banned all outside recording from Atlantic. And so despite the fact that Pickett had recorded several classics down there, they said no more Pickett recordings, no more Don Covey. We're going to keep the studio and the studio team for ourselves.
Now, you would like to go to the live version of In the Midnight Hour?
Yes.
Where was this
live? Well, for several reasons to go there. It was recorded, this version is recorded in Watts, at a nightclub in Watts, three nights before the Watts riots broke out. It's the only time you will ever hear Booker T. Jones playing organ on a Wilson Pickett recording. It's actually the only time I think he ever did play with Pickett, as far as I can tell. The only time that he played live with Booker T and the MGs, even though they'd been his backing band in the studio, different forms of them, not including Booker T. Jones. And the other voice you're going to hear introducing him is the magnificent Montague, who's worth a biography in his own right. He's still alive. He did write a memoir. He was a DJ who helped break Wilson Pickett in New York, a very ambitious DJ, an amazing, fascinating collector of African-American culture, Arcana. He's got a museum's worth, which hopefully one day will go on show as a museum. So what you're hearing here is a club audience. It's a Stax tour. And you hear Montague and Pickett riffing off each other. The version is pretty long. You probably won't have time for all of it. But you hear, if we get there, you'll hear Montague and Pickett going, burn, burn, burn. And that was Montague's phrase, burn, baby, burn. Mm-hmm. And 3 days after this concert was when Watts burned down. So there's a lot to read into this. But the version, if we even just get as far as the opening chords and hearing, you've got two white guys there, Steve Cropper and Donald Duck Dunn. Some of the Stax musicians, the backing bands, would have I'm pretty sure been the only white people in the place. The singers and a lot of the other musicians were African-American, and the audience was exclusively so. But when you hear this version, it is so powerful. Again, I love it for that. And the fact that it's on this particular CD makes it worth playing.
Well, let's go to that. That was the wrong one.
I'll talk for you. You try it again. So, yeah, the Watts Ballroom, summer of 65. I think it's August 65. I obviously know all this stuff when I'm writing the book. You could just go forward one track at a time if you want and just see if that gets us there. You have that forward button somewhere? What's track 14? We could always just play it and I'll talk about this song. We can always just do that. Play the song we got. Oh, yeah. Pretty Mustang Sally. You've been running all over the town now. Oh, I guess I have to put your flat feet on the ground. When I said that, listen, all you want to do is ride around Saturday.
Well, we just got a little bit of Mustang Sally.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Pickett, so you mentioned Muscle Shoals earlier, and after Stax made Outside Artists Unwelcome, by absolutely perfect timing, a guy called Rick Hall, who owned Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, tipped Jerry Wexler off to Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman, which Atlantic snapped up, and it became the first Southern Soul number one hit. And it wasn't actually recorded at Fame. It was recorded at another studio in Muscle Shoals. And Muscle Shoals is in the northwest of Alabama. And it's a very hip area within. It's where Sam Phillips comes from. Buddy Killen comes from there. It's not the backwoods like southern Alabama where Pickett was from. And so Pickett was sent down there to record it. His very first session, he did Land of a Thousand Dances. There's a lot of it. People may have seen the documentary about Muscle Shoals that was on PBS a lot over the last few years. The interesting story there is that the musicians are all white, because some of the greatest soul recordings ever were recorded at Fame. And a lot of us grew up just assuming that it's a really interesting thing. We just assumed that these soulful musicians were African American, and they're not. They're the mainstays of the band are young white guys who just learned, as more and more black artists came in to record there, their roots were already there, and they just got better and better at the music, and it was just became part of their own soul. So yeah, it's a fascinating thing. Mustang Sally was recorded at maybe the second or third time Pickett went down to fame. And that Spooner Oldham you hear on the organ there, you hear Jimmy Johnson on guitar, Roger Hawkins on drums. I think Chips Moman is also on guitar. The horn players may have been moonlighting in from Memphis. They probably did come over from Memphis. The interesting story there, and it's one that checks out with pretty much everybody who was there, is that they nailed this recording in one take. And Spooner Oldham, who's not one given to any exaggerations at all, said it was down tools, go straight to the control room. He said there's an instinct when you know you've done the take. You don't sit there and wait for somebody to say it sounds good. You take your headphones off if you're wearing them and you walk to the control room. And everybody knew that they got this take right, like immediately. And in the excitement, somebody sat on the main tape machine or did something or hit a button and it spun out of control. It spun forward at full tilt and the tape tore with it and tore into multiple pieces. And everybody kind of looked at each other and Pickett was ready to hit the roof.
Because they knew it was golden.
They knew it was golden and that you weren't going to get that again. Yeah. And Atlantic had sent the famed and venerable Tom Dowd down to oversee that session. Tom Dowd is a legendary enough figure. You can find your own documentaries about Tom Dowd. And very calmly, he said, okay, everybody, lunch break. Come back in 45 minutes to an hour. Be calm. And he put it together like a jigsaw puzzle and put the entire tapes I'm always a little bit wary of stories like this. You usually find somebody who says, no, you know what, it didn't happen. Everybody who was there tells me it happened, and including, like I say, Spooner, he's not somebody given to exaggeration, that there are pieces as small as a quarter inch, there are 2-inch pieces, and Tom Dowd managed to get them in order, splice them back together.
Physically
take them back together. There's one point I'm noting that in the book that is either a very nifty little drum shuffle off the beat by Roger Hawkins, or it's the only evidence of the tape being put back together. But of course, it's become the benchmark template recording for Mustang Sally, so it just goes to show.
So I think now I'm technically apt at getting our in the midnight hour up and running, so let's see if Chad can do that.
Lord have mercy. Lord have mercy. You know, yeah baby, listen, I wonder how many of you tonight are willing to wait till the midnight hour. I wonder how many of you tonight feel that the midnight hour is the right time to wait. Let me just say, yeah. Lord have mercy. I'm going to sing a song tonight.
Go ahead, sir.
Monique.
Yes, sir.
I got to sing this song.
I know you got to sing it because you feel good.
You know why I got to sing it?
Why you got to sing it?
You made it possible for me to sing it.
I want
to
thank you.
You told the soul sisters.
I tried to talk to them.
You told the soul brothers.
I tried to talk to them.
They got to wait.
They got to wait.
They got to wait.
In the heart, they got to wait.
Way over.
Yes, sir.
In the midnight hour.
Let me hear you say it again.
Yeah.
If I can only just let me hear you say it one more time, sir.
Yeah. Twinkle in your eyes. Gonna wait midnight, that's when my love begins to shine. Listen, you're the only girl I know. You really love me so.
That's just a little bit of the live version in the Midnight Hour. And Tony and I were speaking during the song about he never did the live version of a song that he did in the studio the same way.
Well, you mentioned the guy's name, Dan Cipriano, and I managed to quickly look up the quote. Cipriano played with Pickett. He was a sax player from 1999 through 2004. Said, let's say I played Midnight Hour with him 250 times. He never sang the first line the same way, ever. He'd start on a higher note, a lower note, and everyone knows how it starts on the record, and maybe he did that once. And I don't know that that was... I think that Pickett instinctually just actually couldn't necessarily do it the same way twice, because that's just not how he was raised. And interestingly, sometimes he wanted the band's to perform. During that same period, I heard from musicians who were disappointed. They wanted to play, and we just heard Mustang Sally a couple of songs ago, who wanted to play Mustang Sally the way they'd heard it on the record, because it's such a great recording. And Pickett was like, no, don't play it that way. Don't play it that way. He wanted like a simpler version that was easier for him to vamp on. So there were a couple of complaints I got from people who said, I ended up feeling like I was in a bar band. I didn't want to do the bar band version of Mustang Sally. I wanted to be...
the legendary song.
Yeah, I wanted to be whoever was playing on that record in the first place. Yeah. I wanted to be that person, not, I wanted to be Tommy Cogbill. I wanted to be Spooner Oldham or Jimmy Johnson or Chips Moman. I didn't want to be like, you know, it's a song that's been abused so much, Mustang Sally. So, but Pickett, I don't think he was capable. It's a church way of singing where you just don't sing the same way twice.
Now, since we're now three quarters through the program, and Tony and I we could easily do 6+ hours of Wilson Pickett stories. We're never going to get to everything. But before we go any further, Tony, you have, since this is the breaking week of the book, you have some readings coming up.
Yes, I do. And thanks for letting me just put in a plug. The one up here in the Hudson Valley is next Tuesday, January 10th. It's at Barnes & Noble in Kingston. That's in the Hudson Valley Mall area in Kingston. And... these events are always free, by the way. It will start at 7 p.m. prompt. What's nice about this is I have three musicians from my little part of the world, which is in the Catskills, just over the river, and they are going to be coming in and playing some Wilson Pickett songs. I'm going to read about the recordings of specific songs, and I'm going to say, well, that's not the version you're going to hear. And these guys have a regular weekly house party, which is sort of invite only, but they know these songs, and I think it's going to be really, really cool. So it's a chance to, I'll read from the book, it's a chance to hear music, it's a chance to meet other people into Pickett, and of course it's a chance to buy the book, because, you know, I do this for love, but it's meant to be a career. Later on, February 18th, there will also be a reading at the Golden Notebook on Saturday, February 18th, President's Weekend. That's the Golden Notebook in Woodstock. If anybody's listening in New York City, next Monday, January 9th, is the official first reading at Greenlight in Fort Greene in Brooklyn, with a wine reception to follow. All these events are free, and they're all at 7 p.m.
You're also going to be with John Gould.
Yeah, down in Brooklyn. Yeah, Jonathan Gould, who joined me on this show. That hour went quickly once you get Jonathan and I talking. So he is going to host me on Monday. His Otis Redding biography is following in the late spring, which I... I hope it does really, really well. I know how much work he's put into that book as well. So we came on a couple of years back and talked about our work as biographers, and we were both we were very helpful to each other. It was nice to have somebody you could call on and say, do you happen to know about this part of Wilson's career? And he could call me and say, do you happen to know about this part of Otis Redding's? So,
and because Otis died at a very young age.
Yes, he did. He had his plane crashed, and It was truly a disaster. Otis was beloved by everybody, I think, who came into contact with him. He seems to have been, I'm not his biographer, he seems to have been an extremely good person. Pickett had a very dark side to him, which came to the fore more and more over the years. He was raised tough. He was raised with his fists, and he used his fists on a lot of people. It's not an attractive aspect of him. It's not something to take any delight in writing about. I don't particularly try and make any excuses for it. I can certainly say he was raised that way, and that people who were beaten as kids may well beat their own kids, that there's a cycle of violence. I can also point to the fact that not all of his siblings turned out that way. So there are different ways you can look at this and talk about cause and effect. Maybe the kindest thing I can say about it is that I don't think he was actually any worse than James Brown. We revere James Brown. Ike Turner, I think Ike Turner's, Tina Turner got the last word on their relationship. But there were a lot of these people around that we revere as musicians who were very tough people to work for. A lot of people that I spoke to said that Wilson Pickett was the greatest musician they ever worked with. He was the most fun. He was the best leader. They had their best times. They made the best music. I did find people who said, yes, but ... I saw some things I didn't expect to see while working in a band. There is that side to it, unfortunately. And he was like that way with his women as well later in life.
You bring up a point where later in his career, he goes to Canada to perform. And since he had been in jail, he needed, permission. And talking about the Grammys, it was a very difficult life for many of that generation where James Brown spent time in jail, Ike Turner, Wilson Pickett.
Johnny Taylor, a lot of them did, yes. There's a lot that you can read into that because we don't necessarily have time to get off into the aspect of how these guys end up in jail and the Keith Richards of this world don't. That there's a lot of things you can read into that about the American jail system being a racist system. And I think that's sort of something worth mentioning. I think in Pickett's case, he probably deserved to be in jail. It was the best place for him at a certain point. So I'm not really going to defend that. But the point to make is that these guys came up hard and they fell very, very hard. And I make a big argument for Wilson Pickett here as being somebody who for about 20, 25 years was at the vanguard of Black American music from sort of joining his father in Detroit. For the next 15 to 20 years, he was not just at the front. He was the vanguard. He was the guy carrying the flag, leading the music into battle. There were so many firsts that applied to Wilson Pickett, but it meant that when the music finally overtook him, as it will tend to do, it was really a matter of in the 70s when soul music got softer, got more strings-based, more synthetic, started moving towards disco, the Saturn and sequence suits came out, and the voices went up an octave to falsetto, and there was no place for a guy who was a foot-stomping shouter from the church. And when these guys went out of favor, they fell pretty hard, and not having the management around them, not having the education, maybe not having the advice, just a lot of different things. And maybe they'd already got onto their vices and their vices just overtook them. And a lot of these people became addicts of some kind and also became very violent. So James Brown is one of them and Wilson Pickett's another.
I think Wilson was also a great funk artist.
Well, he was. And among the firsts he's the first person to take the word funk into the American charts with Funky Broadway. It wasn't his song. It was a group called Dyke and the Blazers who actually moved from, I think it was either Rochester or Buffalo, New York, to Phoenix, Arizona, believe it or not, which is where they had their recording. Pickett was the kind of guy that he didn't write that many of his hits in the Midnight Hour aside. He was the kind of person who could take a song that was a marginal soul R&B hit, So Mustang Sally is a great example. Funky Broadway is a good example. She's Looking Good is another good example, just to name three. They were all reasonable record successes in the R&B charts. He could come along and record a definitive version that for most people stands as the original. And that's what, you know, we played Mustang Sally. Same with Funky Broadway. There's the original version is pretty cool. It's got funk. The singer's not that great. I mean, it's a good groove. Mm. But Pickett did it with his band, and boom, another top 10 hit and another benchmark recording. So absolutely, he had the funk. And while we associate James Brown with that word, as we do James Brown with soul music, yeah, Pickett had funk in a lot of his song titles. And like I say, hey, he's the first person to put it in the charts. Counts for something.
And even in Wilson's later years, there were times where his voice was failing, but there were other times when he could be brought up and he could hit the high notes so well. And he's known for that. You can hear, even in the screaming, he could hear a real note happening.
Very, very important to say. This is a quote I'm going to use a lot that... I think it is accredited to Jerry Wexler that when James Brown screamed, it was a scream. When Wilson Pickett screamed, it was a note. Mm. And Pickett could hit a scream and then sort of vibrate it. He could send it up, send it down. And it didn't wear out his voice the way that it would wear out other singers' voices. He was born with that. He worked at it. He had something fortunate. You know, we all have our talents, mm-hmm. and he had that scream, and he made sure he used it. It didn't hold out till the very end, but I don't think his voice ever became a true a mockery of itself. His voice did weaken over the years, as most people's do. Mm-hmm. But even at the very end, I mean, there's a performance where he comes back. He gets to appear in Blues Brothers 2000, an atrocious film, by the way, a painful to watch. Mm. But he and Eddie Floyd do a cameo of 6, 3, 4, 5, 7, 8, 9. They perform it on the Letterman show with the Blues Brothers band in front of the Letterman band. And the two of them just pick up. It's sort of where they left off in the Falcons. It's a hell of a performance. So that's approximately the year 2000. So that's getting close to Pickett's. He died in 2006. The performance is stunning. Mm. So given the right material, albeit old material, given the right band, given the right environment, given the fact that he had really at that point was determined to try and sort himself out, he still had that voice. And I saw him in 2002 at a show, a lunchtime show in Brooklyn, and he had it, man. I mean, I've seen a lot of quite sad performances over the years, but he really, really had it. He really did.
When was the time... which was a sort of a turning point for him, was when he entered rehab.
Mm-hmm.
Got a chance to get off the heavy liquor and the drugs he was doing. And he started going around and to some of his old bandmates and apologizing for his bad behavior. He entered sort of an interesting point of his life because he was still touring.
Mm-hmm. He was.
And recording, and you know, he's a very vibrant.
He was recording when he could, Chad, because he got to the point he made one album in 12 years because he was kind of persona non grata. He was untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. He hit a point that it was his second jail term, and I don't think he had a particular epiphany or road to Damascus. He never completely sobered up. He was not a truly reformed character. He was irascible to the end. But I think he sobered up enough and he corrected himself enough that he was able to come out and say, okay, I'm going to have another go. And this time around, he found the right producer who helped him find the right record deal and helped him record the right record. And he did get a Grammy nomination. And I know Pickett was upset he didn't win because Pickett always thought he was the best and he didn't like losing that nomination to Barry White. But hey, he did get his Grammy nomination. He did make a good record at the end. And you're right, he bumped into some people and apologized, particularly for his actions back in the early 80s when he was way out of control, primarily on cocaine. And it took a lot probably for Pickett to apologize for something. So I think he recognized he recognized he probably didn't have that much time left, and he wanted to make sure he left a better final mark on his career.
And he redeemed himself for the Grammys because he, or the
so Hall of Fame,
Hall of Fame,
yeah.
Because the first time he was inducted, he did not go.
No.
But he came back and did a great performance.
He came back and performed with Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
And told Bruce, yeah, I'm going to, it was in the midnight hour, and said, yeah, I'm going to kick your ass on this. I think that was a rehearsed threat. Mm. No, he missed. He's. I don't know if there's been another major artist who said they would attend their induction and then didn't show. He was apparently got too wired in his house, just with nerves. It's one of these people you think he's incredibly confident, charismatic. His nerves got the better of him, and he didn't come out of the house when the limo showed up. So several years later, he came back and delivered a great performance. And when he died, it's very nice. Bruce led the band on at the Grammys in a tribute to Wilson Pickett. And Sam Moore also sung there. And Sam Moore was one of the ones who'd been on the receiving end of Pickett's crazy years. And so there's a nice sense that I think the finale is that goodbye at the Grammys from these musicians is a very sweet goodbye.
So, Tony, we've come to the end of our hour.
Yeah. How did that happen?
Well, it's a fascinating subject, In the Midnight Hour by Tony Fletcher. Tony, you must have a website that you can tell our audience.
I do have a website, yes. It's ijamming.net, I for internet, jamming for jamming.net. That's my website. At Twitter, it's nice and easy. It's just Tony Fletcher. The book is it's published by Oxford University Press and in hardback and ebook. And it's a proper, proper publisher. So basically, where they sell books, you should be able to get this, I'm sure, locally, from the Spotty Dog to the Golden Notebook to Barnes & Noble, all the online retailers, if that's what you prefer. I always say support your local bookstore because they depend on you.
Absolutely. And thank you, Tony, for joining us on The Art of the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, thank you.
And we're going to say, signing off, this is Chad Weckler, and I will see you next month.